The title of this lecture is Hayek and Friedman head-to-head. I've already done the Hayek and Keynes one, but as you'll see, Keynes plays a role in this story too. We just can't get rid of him. We'll see how that works out. Let me start by saying that if my focus were different than it is today, I would have a lot of good things to say about Milton Friedman, a lot of nice things to say about that man, both personally and academically. Many of you know that he was a founding member, along with Hayek, of the Montpelerin Society. He wrote Capitalism and Freedom and Free to Choose, books that were very influential and moved people's thinking towards the libertarian pole. He was a key player. This is a special place in my heart, a key player to eliminating the military draft. It was almost a one-man show to get that done. And my only complaint was that he didn't do it quick enough to save me from spending 4 years in the Mohawk Valley, which wasn't too bad. It's between the Adirondacks and the Catskills, and not a bad place to be in the military. But glad to see he eliminated the military draft. Spotlight of the lectures this morning, of course, as you could guess, is on macro and specifically on business cycles. So let's light into it and see what we can get here. The first little part of this I call the level of aggregation. And an important question was asked in one of my earlier lectures about the notion of aggregation, and is that a problem, and so on, with the Austrians. Austrians aggregating just somehow doesn't sound right. But I think we can make the case. And it's here where I want to bring in Keynes, that he'll come back again several times. And this is just the sort of the most concise way I can characterize Keynes and his macroeconomics, his business cycle theory, for that matter. Theorizing at a high level of aggregation, and he certainly does. That's income and consumption and investment. Those are his variables. John Maynard Keynes argued that market economies perform perversely, especially the market mechanisms that are supposed to bring saving and investment in balance with one another. Seeing unemployment and resource idleness as the norm, Keynes called for countercyclical fiscal and monetary policies, and ultimately, in his Swan Song chapter 24, called for a comprehensive socialization of investment. The fiscal and monetary policies were supposed to be just enough to keep the economy from totally collapsing and giving us time to usher in reforms in the direction of socialized investment. That's Keynes, okay? Well, let's compare that then with Friedman. And here, even though I've praised him for all of his libertarian writings and so on this level of aggregation, he doesn't get high marks. Milton Friedman's monetarism was based on a still higher level of aggregation. The equation of exchange, MV equal PQ, most of you know what this. How many have seen that in the textbook and written it down on a test? Okay, I've put the symbols and their meaning: M, the quantity of money; V, the velocity of money, the rate of turnover, circulation through the economy; P, the price level; and Q stands for quantity. Q, big Q, macro quantity, real gross domestic product. In other words, all the output in the economy. The equation of exchange made use of an all-inclusive output variable Q, putting into eclipse the issue of the allocation of resources between current consumption and investment for the future. You see, Keynes at least divided output in terms of consumption and investment. Even that was too high a level of aggregation, but Friedman one-upped him and just lumped them together and called it output. I might point out that in his empirical work, he actually used income as a proxy for output, real income, which is symbolized by Y in a lowercase y. The equation looks kind of funny. All capital letters except that income, and it's lowercase. In monetarist lingo, lowercase means real. Seems like it ought to be the other way. Capital should be real, you know. The capital case should be real, but lowercase y. Well, okay, we'll let him get away with that. Seeing no problem emerging from the market itself, I mean, he was in favor of markets. He thought they worked. So he didn't see any problems there. So Friedman focused on the relationship between government-controlled money supply and the overall price level, right? That's Friedman. And now let's look at Hayek. Capital-based macroeconomics is distinguished by its propitious disaggregation. I make my sophomores look up the word propitious. This means well chosen, okay? Chosen for the task at hand. Which brings into view both the problem of intertemporal resource allocation and the potential for a market solution, right? So that's what makes that level of aggregation sort of all right with most Austrians. So Hayek showed that a coordination of saving and investment decisions could be achieved by market governed movements in the interest rate. He also recognized that this aspect of the market economy is especially vulnerable to the manipulation of interest rates by the central bank. Well, boy, that sort of sets it up. I mean, if you understand what that Austrian theory of the business cycle is, you can almost milk that theory out of that little summary and see why Hayek is working at that particular level of aggregation or disaggregation. Okay. Now, one of the things, was sort of the major theme here, is about how methods shape substance. And don't get worried. I'm not going to talk like Roderick Long does or David Gordon. I couldn't do that if I wanted to. Okay, I'm sorry. But when I say methods, I mean sort of workaday methods. How do these people go about doing economics? And we'll see. So contrasting methods. Once again, here comes Keynes, but we need him, as you'll see why. And Alan Meltzer, who himself is a monetarist, had an apt description of Keynes and how he went about his business. And here's what he said. Keynes was a type of theorist who developed his theory after he had developed a sense of relative magnitudes and of the size and frequency of changes in these magnitudes, okay? So he just looked around and see what's moving the most, what's flopping around out there big time, okay? Let's look at those things. Okay, now we've got, you know, we know what we're going to theorize in terms of. Well, when he was looking around in the 1930s to write the general theory, he saw income and consumption and investment moving pretty dramatically. Well, that's it, okay? We've got to figure out what's going on in terms of those variables. That's how we choose our variables. And this is what he did. And this, this is still Meltzer quote. I put Meltzer down here. A different interpretation. It's not really, Meltzer's book is not really a different interpretation. That's what he named it. It's just a taking Keynes for his word kind of a book, which I really like. Keynes concentrated on those magnitudes that change the most, often assuming that others remain fixed for the relevant period. Now, I think Keynes missed out on seeing those things as fixed, and I'm not sure he understood what the relevant period was. In Austrian economics, sometimes instead of talking about short run and long run, that's sort of boilerplate lingo in the mainstream, we like to talk about the cycle-relevant run, okay? And it's longer than the short run and shorter than the long run, but it's cycle-relevant. And it's the time period where capital does get misallocated and then has to be reallocated. But Keynes is probably looking at a shorter period, and during that period, well, there just wasn't much opportunity to change capital, especially fixed capital, plant and equipment, and so on. It's there. It is what it is, and let's just look at income and consumption and investment and that sort of thing, okay? Now, Friedman, and this is something you might, it'll set you back on your heels, I think. This comes out of a book by John Burton. Milton Friedman says, I believe that Keynes' theory is the right kind of theory in its simplicity, its concentration on a few key magnitudes, the ones that flop around the most, and its potential fruitfulness. All right? Well, actually, at the time that Friedman said that, the potential had turned into an actuality, that it was potential only with Keynes. He theorized in terms of those magnitudes, but he didn't have any data. All right? In fact, the data, the whole national income accounts, were created after the general theory and in response to the general theory to get the data to see what really was going on out there. So Simon Kuznets in the United States and Richard Stone in England both got the Nobel Prize at different times for their work in creating this national income accounts so that you could test or illustrate or whatever the Keynesian ideas. Well, of course, at this point, when Friedman made this statement, he had that data. He had the data. So he could see what it showed. Now, another thing Keynes said in a different place, it was a 1968 article in Time magazine. He said, we're all Keynesians now. Okay? Which kind of makes you wonder, really? Did Friedman say that? Well, he did, but said later that he was taken out of context. I'll get to that. He was taken out of context. Well, what is the context that he was taken out of? Or how was it taken? What did people think that Friedman meant? Well, at about that same time, this is 1968, a statement almost identical to this was made by, guess who? Richard Nixon. Okay, have you heard this? So here you have both Friedman and Nixon saying we're all Keynesians now. So sort of ominous thing. But Richard Nixon meant, now that he's won the presidency, that now we all believe that we need to manipulate the policy variables, have discretionary fiscal policy, discretionary monetary policy to try to make the economy behave more like it's supposed to than like it does. Okay. That's my characterization. But that's what he meant, okay? He's talking about using the policy tools. And, of course, that happens to all presidents. Once you get them in the presidency, and those are the tools that they have at their disposal, directly or at one remove, well, they're going to use them, okay? Now, it turns out that's not what Friedman meant. In fact, if you read on in Friedman's piece, he explains it this way. We all use the Keynesian language and apparatus. In other words, Y and C and I. And with Friedman, he does it mostly empirically, looking at correlations between these things. Now, we can pick at this, too. We can say, okay, you didn't mean the Nixon thing, but look what you said. We all use these. Do all of us use these? No, the Keynesians and the monetarists used these, okay? Keynesians invented it, and Friedman, in an early 1970 article, set out the principles of monetarism in terms of the Keynesian framework. It was the ISLM framework, which is one stage above the C plus I plus G framework. And he had all the ISLM curves going, and he showed what the monetarists thought in terms of stability of the curves and in terms of elasticities of the curves and so on. So it's certainly true that he, or the monetarists, were Keynesians now in that sense. They used the Keynesian apparatus. But it's certainly not true that all economists were. The Austrians were not, never have been, never will be, I hope. Later, much later, 1999, so almost 30 years after he wrote this, he was in the Wall Street Journal, a little interview, and he said that that article setting out monetarism in terms of Keynesian magnitudes was the biggest mistake he ever made. It was the biggest mistake he ever made. Wow. Okay, he fessed up. But he never did say what framework he should have used, because he didn't have one apart from MV equal PQ, and that doesn't take you very far. Okay, so he didn't have some alternative macroeconomic framework, and that we're just left not knowing what he would have done instead. Now, here's the big contrast is between Keynes and Friedman on one hand and Hayek on the other. The role of the economist, Hayek points out, this is in the Pure Theory of Capital, is precisely to identify the features of the market process that are hidden to the untrained eye. What a difference, okay? We're not just looking around to see what's flopping the most wildly, okay? We're looking at a point before things started flopping around and saying, well, what's going on here that's going to cause trouble, okay? And of course, he found it in the movements of the interest rate as guided by the Federal Reserve, the market rate being different than the so-called natural rate and giving you an artificial boom that eventually turns into a bust. So that's key to understand what their methods were, what they went about doing. So this is my own summary. For Hayek, then, the cause and effect relationship between central bank policy during the boom and the subsequent economic downturn have a first-order claim on our attention. Despite the more salient movements in macroeconomic magnitudes that characterize the post-crisis spiraling downward of the economy into deep depression, a lot of economists are totally dismissive of the Austrian view, because when they look at, quote, the data, and what they're looking at is the economy crashing into depression, they see that consumption and investment are moving the same direction. So how can you Austrians say that there's a problem when it moves and they move in opposite direction? They don't move in opposite direction, they move in the same direction. It just hits you in the face overwhelmingly in the data, all right? But of course, Hayek is looking at the period before that, the 1920s, and he sees that an interest rate that's artificially low will stimulate long-term investment, all right? And so investment will get out of kilter with people's consumption preferences and eventually lead to depression, right? Now, this is Hayek himself in his Nobel lecture. And he, in the context, you can say he has exactly this business about methods in his mind. So he says there may well exist better scientific evidence, and scientific is in scare quotes, you know, he's kind of sneering at scientific evidence that is empirically demonstrated regularities among key macroeconomic magnitudes, C and I and G and so on. Better evidence for a false theory, which will be accepted because it is more, quote, scientific, than for a valid theory, which is rejected because there is no significant quantitative evidence for it. That might be too strong to say there's no significant quantitative evidence for it, but what he has in mind here, I think, is that there is plenty of historical evidence. In other words, if you don't just take empirical evidence to mean those things that can be counted, you mean empirical in the broader sense of historical understanding what's going on in the economy during the 20s. That's from his pretense of knowledge lecture. Now, because of these workaday methods being different, and because of the different conceptions of how to go about doing economics, we get a different focus on the issue of business cycles. Let's see how that goes. We've seen in my previous lectures, Keynes attributes the downturn to psychological factors affecting the investment community rather than to movements in the interest rate. So he's not even offering an economic explanation of the initial downturn. It's psychological. And he has some verbiage about, well, the future is uncertain. There's a fog, cloud of uncertainty. And in those conditions, people can lose their nerve, okay? Lose the fire in the belly and so on. And the economy turns down. It's a psychological thing. And it didn't bother Keynes because, you know, that wasn't his focus anyhow. He said, look, something caused the economy to turn down. We're not sure what it was. Probably a psychological, you know, psychological thing. And he even said this was the general idea. He said, I suggested a more typical, often predominant explanation of the crisis is a sudden collapse of the marginal efficiency of capital. That's just the expected rate of return on capital, which, again, he's talking about investment. Sudden collapse in the demand for investment goods. Why is that? Well, it's that psychological thing. And so he says these things just to sort of divert attention from them because as far as economic theory goes, it has nothing to say about that. And his focus instead is different. Keynes' main focus is on the dynamics of the subsequent downward spiral and on policies aimed at reversing the spiral's direction. When you start reading Keynesian stuff, pay attention. They're going to talk about a business cycle or whatever. They end up focusing on the question of how a bad situation gets worse. And you get to that point, and over here, the bad situations get worse because falling this causes falling that, and falling that causes falling this. And it just keeps going down. So they say, wait a minute, let me back up a few pages and find out how it got bad in the first place. So that I can now learn how bad things get worse. Well, you don't find it unless it's back to the animal spirits, okay? So the point is, he doesn't want to talk about what starts it. He wants to talk about what it looks like in progress and what the government can do to turn it around, okay? That's his idea. Okay, let's take a look at Friedman. Friedman is dismissive of the whole issue of the cause of the initial downturn in 1929. And you can look in his tome, the huge book, Monetary History of the U.S., and you can see that. You think, well, gee, if he's got this many pages, you ought to have something in there to say about what caused the downturn. And he just refers the downturn, and I've collected these expressions, to the downturn, the initial downturn, oh, that was just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, routine, garden-variety recession, which are just dismissive as if you don't need a theory of that. It was just an ordinary recession, you know. It was no big deal. And the real problem began after that when you got the spiraling down. So he's really with Keynes on this issue. But instead of saying animal spirits, he just blows off the whole question by using this kind of terminology, right? So his focus is on policy blunders, mostly monetary policy blunders, that occurred on the heels of the downturn and on the correlation between a decrease in the money supply and the decrease in GDP. So again, now see, he's got the data, both monetary and fiscal, and so on. He's got the data, and he can show the downward movements in M and Q. I didn't get this from a citation. I just sort of channeled Friedman, and this is the way he talks. Okay, so Friedman would say, might as well say, the correlation between movements in money supply and the movements in the total output leaves no doubt as to the central issue. In other words, those are the things we're going to find the R-square for. We're going to correlate those and see how close they come together. That's it. We've got it down to that point. All right. Now let's look at Hayek. Hayek focused on the policy-infected aspects of the boom and their implications for the boom's sustainability. The post-bust reallocation of labor and capital takes time. Yeah, we all know that. But the particular dimensions of, say, the Great Depression, its length and depth, are to be explained largely in terms of the policy perversities that hampered the recovery. All right? There are lots of critics, early critics even, of the Austrian school. Gottfried Habeler is one of them. And he offers as the reason for his eventually rejecting the Austrian theory is that he looked at the monumental damage done to the economy between 29 and 39 and couldn't imagine that that could be attributable to some relatively small difference between what the interest rate was and what it should have been. That's just too small a cause to cause that huge effect. So much for the Austrians, okay? So I'll make 2 points about that. One is, well, he's right, it didn't cause all that. What caused most of that, what caused the Depression to be as bad as it was all the perversities during the Hoover and Roosevelt era, Hoover's high wage policy, and Roosevelt's policy of putting workers out into the forest to trim trees and so on, to Roosevelt's high profits tax, to the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and on, things that hobbled the economy and kept it from recovering. All right, that was it. Now, the Depression, nonetheless, might have been pretty bad, but not as bad as all that, okay? And yet that doesn't dissuade us from saying, well, it couldn't have been caused by this small thing in the 20s, you know? It's as if a big cause is necessary to have a big effect. And you can think of things like that. I mean, Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii come to mind. A big cause, a big effect, okay? But how about a careless smoker causing a forest fire? Couldn't possibly cause a forest fire. The cigarette was only about that long, you know? It's a little bitty cause. So it doesn't, the cause and effect doesn't have to be proportional in size in any case. It occurs to me to put this query up. Can we justifiably say that the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust? A lot of people say that. Rothbard says it, and it requires a little interpretation, I think. It's true, but only in a sense. In other words, if we imagine an Austrian business cycle, an artificial boom that then turned down, and if we could imagine, this is quite an imagination, if we imagine that the government after that point didn't do anything that was perverse, nothing, okay, then it's true that however big that dip is going to reflect how great the disturbance was. If you discoordinate the economy to a large degree, well, it'll take longer to rectify itself. But it's not true to just apply it loosely and historically to say the Great Depression, because so many other things were going on during the 1930s, perverse things, that made the Depression much, much worse than it otherwise would have had to be. Okay? Now, watching the time, but I want to take a few minutes to tell you about sort of to seal this idea so you see you don't forget it, okay? Because I've had correspondence with Lanny Ebenstein, who has written 2 books on Hayek. And at one point I had mentioned, he's written on Friedman too, in the debates between them. And I mentioned about Friedman saying that about this ordinary depression, garden variety and so on. And he shot back an email and said, well, it was a garden variety recession, as if this was not to be disputed. And of course, the implication is you don't have to pay any attention to it. It's not worth worrying about. It's only a garden variety recession. And my point is, that's just the wrong focus. So we need to explain why the downturn happened. That's the key. That's what Hayek was doing. And so I wrote him, this is just a summary here, and I'm going to skip it because of time. I wrote him this thing about the case of the cabbage-eating Mississippi monster. I don't know if you've heard about this or not. And it's Austrian and Chicago methodology in action. And let's see how it goes. Suppose in late October 1929, a 1,000-pound monster descends on Mississippi soil and spent the next 3.5 years eating all the cabbages and quite a few rabbits between Tupelo and Pascagoula. Okay. By early March of 1933, the monster weighed 4,000 pounds. Right? Now, two investigators are sent to Mississippi to get a handle on the situation. One's from Vienna and the other one's from Chicago. Could you tell this story on your own? The Viennese investigator asked, where in the world did this hideous thing come from, you know? A little investigation, historical investigation. Turns out, on further investigation, the monster was the unintended consequence of some ill-conceived government-sponsored bionics program. Got that problem solved, you know. No question about it. Okay. The Chicagoan shows up, and I'm putting a little personalities in here, too. Shoves the Austrian aside, you know, and says, never mind how the thing got here. The real question is, how did it grow from 1,000 pounds to 4,000 pounds? How did an ordinary run-of-the-mill garden variety monster quadruple in weight in 40 months? Okay. Chicagoan's answer, of course, is it was all those cabbages. Couldn't get good data on the rabbits. I'm sorry. So the correlation between cabbage consumption and weight gain of the Mississippi monster leaves no doubt about the central issue. I never heard back from Lanny Ebenstein about that. And then, as a tag here, do we suspect that the data availability is what led the Chicagoan to his conclusion, and that the lack of hard data on pertaining to the monster's origin caused him to be dismissive of the questions about where the thing came from? These and related suspicions are what underlie the message of Hayek's Nobel address, Pretense of Knowledge, okay? And one thing I might point out, getting out of Mississippi here for a minute, there was a series of interviews done by Randall Parker 10 years ago or so, interviewing different people, including Friedman and Anna Schwartz and others. And he asked them point blank, what do you think actually started the depression? And he said, well, you know, I really don't know, but it might have had something to do with the stock market crash. Just puts that in play. That's the only thing he meant. It might have had something to do with the stock market crash. And then in a separate interview, Anna Schwartz was asked the same thing. And, you know, those were the co-authors, Friedman and Schwartz. They wrote the monetary history. They co-authored a lot of stuff. And Anna Schwartz rejected that idea and even said that, in her view, the price of stocks in early October of 29, that was at the height of the price of stocks, were not too high. That they accurately reflected the prospects of the economy. So she couldn't have blamed the crash on the stock prices. So the two co-authors even just barely mentioned the stock market crash as a possible cause wouldn't be able to agree on whether or not that was the actual cause. Okay. Friedman's monetarism, MV equal PQ, and it goes like this. With a near constant velocity of money, oh, it has a slight trend to it, but we're not going to worry about it. And output growing slowly, and I use a little arrow there. Let's say there's a constant velocity. There's output growing slowly. The price level moves with the money supply. So if the government increases the money supply, then prices will go up. Well, this is a well-duh moment. Say, that's right. And yet, you have to give credit to Friedman, who repopularized this idea even during the Keynesian ascendancy. that it was money that caused inflation. And with a lag, in fact, a lag that's not particularly plausible in terms of monetarism, 18 to 30 months. Why would it take 18? That's what, a year and a half to 2.5 years? Why would it take that long for more money in the economy to show up as higher prices? Even Friedman puzzled over that in one of the last books he wrote called Monetary Mischief. He offered this up as an unsolved problem. We haven't really gotten a handle on that lag. So he wasn't comfortable by just the empiric saying, well, it looks like it takes that long. We'll need to figure out why that is. Inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, most quoted statement out of Friedman's work. And most of us, I think, could go along with that. Kudos to Friedman for making that stick. And of course, by inflation, he means increasing the price level as opposed to the original meaning and the meaning that Mises had that meant an increase in the money supply. Because if it means an increase in the money supply, he's just saying an increase in the money supply is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Yeah, it is. Okay, but of course he meant an increase in the price level. And Friedman's rule, of course, is don't do that. Don't increase the money supply. At least don't increase it any more than long-run real economic growth. And so if the economy is growing a little, then the money supply should grow a little with it. That's even disputed by Hayek, but we'll save that for a different day. And then we're here to ask, but what happens within the quantity aggregate as a result of the monetary injection? In other words, you're still having monetary injection. And the key is that money comes into the economy through credit markets, okay? And even if prices aren't rising, if Q is growing, that pumping money into the economy will cause the interest rate to be lower than what it otherwise would be, okay? And here's just I can just remind you of that by showing you the supply and demand for loanable funds and recognizing that if money is added to that supply, my diagram disappears. There it is. Okay. So that's what Hayek had in mind. In fact, in the 1920s, when Hayek was at New York University for 1 year, he was virtually in the line of sight with the New York Federal Reserve, keeping an eye on them, and suggesting that this boom is not going to be sustainable, even though the rate of increase in the money supply was only enough to keep prices from falling. Okay, Hayek thought they ought to be allowed to fall, and that wouldn't be damaging to the economy. Okay. Friedman, on the other hand, declares the 1920s as the golden years of the Federal Reserve. All right? Those were the golden years. Said the same thing about Greenspan as Greenspan was leaving office, that Greenspan had set the standard. He ignores interest rates during the 1920s because they didn't change much. That is, they didn't pass the Keynes criteria. They didn't change much. And I had some correspondence with Friedman where this issue became a key issue. And so he just sent me a letter and attached to it the time series of interest rates, from about 1915 to 1920 or 1929. And he says, see, look at it, the interest rates didn't change. And of course, you know, if you've done any econometrics, that if you pick an independent variable to put in your equation, if it turns out there's no change in the independent variable, you're pretty much sunk. It's not going to be able to explain, in econometric terms, the dependent variable. So if it doesn't change, sorry, it's not in play. Hayek might ask, I'll ask in his place, but what should they But what if they should have changed, but weren't allowed to? In other words, during the 1920s, there were breakthroughs in technology, which increased the demand for loanable funds and put upward pressure on interest rates. And there was lots going on during the 20s, mass production of automobiles, lots of technological breakthroughs in the chemical industry. There was electrification, which gave a huge boost to appliances, and which then refrigerators and so on, which gave a huge boost to processed foods and so on. So the 20s was a wonderful place, wonderful time to be alive. I wasn't there, you know, but I've heard that it was a fun place to be alive. And so with all that technological innovations and so on, you would expect the interest rate to rise. But the Federal Reserve, guided by the real bills doctrine, met each increase in the demand for credit with an increase in supply, thus keeping the interest rate from rising. That's why it didn't rise, because the Fed was watching interest rates, and if it started ticking up, they'd take it back down. And you can show that. So seeing no change in the interest rate, Friedman dismissed interest rates as a potential independent variable in his econometric equations. Seeing no change in the interest rate when they should have risen because of technological advances, Hayek was able to identify some critical market forces hidden from the untrained eye. See, that's the story. Another query here that occurred to me. Which view, Friedman's or Hayek's, is more firmly anchored in the empirical, that is, historical, circumstances of the 1920s? I think it's the Austrian. They're looking at a sort of a full-bodied history of what was going on in the 20s, and would look at it that way. I think I had the graphs that showed what would happen if the interest rate rise, but I somehow lost it. We'll see about that. Okay. Here's Keynes now. This is a little bit of a summary. Does Keynes recognize the significance of the loanable funds market in the context of business cycles? And the answer, of course, is no. He denies that savings depends on the interest rate, and he all but denies that investment depends on the interest rate. He jettisoned the loanable funds theory. For him, saving is dependent only on income, and investment expenditures are based predominantly on psychological considerations, animal spirits. So there's no room for interest rates there. How about Friedman? Does Friedman recognize the significance of the loanable funds market in the context of business cycles? No, he assumes that this market is working well and so ignores it in dealing with key issues of the relationship between the money supply and the price level. For him, the focus is on total output, Q, as in MV equal PQ, which includes output of both consumption goods and investment goods. He will concede, he has to me, that yes, demand for investment is more variable than demand for consumption, but that's as far as he goes. All right, so we could symbolize this. Just so there's the old saving function, it doesn't have the interest rate in it. And it's not just the basic level of Keynesian theory for which that's true. It's true at all levels of Keynesian theory. Saving doesn't depend on the interest rate. And investment, I equals I zero. Okay, you don't forget that equation, which translates in English, don't ask me what causes I to be I. Just is what it is. Animal spirits, yeah, we know. Okay, so we jettison that. I see my dynamics aren't working like they're supposed to, but that's okay. I can take it. MV equal PQ, that's what he's got to work with. I bet that thing just disappears, it did. So we don't get any loanable funds theory out of this. Now, I see what I'm doing. I'd have that diagram I mentioned a little bit later. Consequences of the housing boom, a critical comparison. What I'm going to do is compare the housing boom with the previous dot-com boom. And show you a couple things. I'll show you why the bust after the housing is so much worse than the bust after dot-com, And I'll show you why interest rates in this episode are so much lower than they were in dot-com, even though in dot-com, interest rates got very low during the downturn. So here we have the dot-com boom and bust, and I underlined that it was that bust was cushioned. It was cushioned with underlying real growth. In other words, dot-com was a magnificent thing. It got going, and we still had it after the bust. We could fall back on it, so to speak. But the housing boom and bust, that bust was compounded by the mortgage market distortion. So it's not we had something real, something good and real to fall back on. We had another fine mess that was underneath the monetary fine mess, okay? And it goes like this. Here's the dot-com episode. And this is a case where there's technological innovation, which increases the demand for loanable funds. So there's upward pressure on the interest rates. Okay? Now, the Fed doesn't like to see that. It's worried that, that's going to cool off the boom. So it increases the money supply just to keep the interest rate from rising. It just pretty much holds it down. But by doing that, it distorts the economy. The interest rates aren't telling the truth. And the economy is entered into an artificial boom. It looks like that. And so you got way too much investment and not enough consumption. And that'll come home to roost at the end of the boom. The artificial boom rides piggyback on the genuine boom. And that was true in the 1920s, too. Technological investment and then the artificial boom rode piggyback on top of that. That's sort of typical of the way business cycles work historically. Now look at the housing, and you see an increased supply of credit put downward pressure on interest rates. And that supply of credit came from the artificial guarantee of all these home mortgages people wanted to borrow. I'm sorry, people wanted to lend in housing because it was safe, okay? Because the government has our back. And so the first thing to happen is that you have an increase in loanable funds. It's not saving. It's a subsidy from the government in the form of guaranteed mortgages, all right? The Fed further increased the supply of loanable funds to avoid reducing lending in other markets. You see, if you subsidize one huge market, then savings tends to go to that market and away from other industry who need credit too. Well, the Fed will have to supply that credit. And they were also supplying more credit still just because they're trying to recover from the dot-com bust. All right? So you had sort of a double whammy increase in the supply of credit. And that's what drove interest rates down so low. And they're kept down in an attempt to rekindle the boom, unfortunately. So the double shift in supply of loanable funds compounded both the downward pressure on interest rates and the excessive borrowing. The artificial boom rode piggyback on a distortion of the mortgage market. So even if we'd dealt successfully with the artificial boom, we also have to deal with the distortions in mortgage markets, which was the initial cause. And here I know you've seen plenty of graphs like this, so I'll just be real brief. On the left, you see that too low, too long, which was interest rates as we were trying to recover from the dot-com bust and aggravating at the same time the boom in real estate. And then, of course, once we got a crash after that, then interest rates went down super low, almost to 0%, and have stayed there ever since. Something that everybody, including Bernanke, would have thought impossible, that you could hold interest rates down for that long a time. But given the conditions, they can do it. Okay. Okay, Friedman's view of the monetary contraction, and here I think I want to flip through this fairly quickly. A sharp monetary contraction puts downward pressure on P and Q. If P is sticky downward, that's sort of a Keynesian term. Actually, P was not allowed to fall during the Depression because of being propped up by all sorts of government programs. So the whole problem wasn't centered on the inability of markets to adjust prices down. It should be centered on the work of government trying to keep prices from falling. So Q fell dramatically. Evidence showed that between October 29 and March of 33, decreasing M was the essential primary dominant cause of the decrease in Q. And so this is what passes in monetarist terms with the theory of the Depression. He's just looking at the downward movements in M and Q. He said, well, that's it. That's what dominates, so forget about all this other stuff. The correlation between movements in the money supply and movements in output leaves no doubt as to the central issue. It's Friedman again. Now, a certain irony of monetarism. You all know what regulation Q is. That's not the same Q as in MV equal BQ. Q is just the Qth regulation of the Federal Reserve. And it's a regulation that put limits on the payment of interest. And it set things up where you could have a checking account, but it wasn't allowed to draw interest. You have a saving account, but you weren't allowed to write checks. So checking and saving become sort of totally different. You can either have checking, no interest, but you can write checks, or saving, get interest, can't write checks. All right? And those were imposed between about 36 and 37. There was some legislation, and then they were relaxed in about 82. Okay? So there was a period there between the late 30s and the early 80s when the monitors had a good handle on what constitutes the money supply. It's that M1. It's that stuff that's confined by regulation Q. So all the empirical work was in terms of a well-defined monetary aggregate. Okay, but when that got taken off and before that was put on, you couldn't quite say what the money supply would be because it's there's sort of a blend from moneyness to saving and from low interest on checking account to a little higher interest on saving account and so on. So you can't quite draw a line saying, okay, this is money and the rest of the stuff isn't. And this came out in a Senate hearing, actually Joint Economic Committee hearing with Alan Greenspan. And he was asked a question about why aren't you controlling the money supply? Why are you manipulating interest rates? So that was considered Keynesian, you're manipulating interest rates. Why aren't you paying attention to the money supply? And here's Greenspan's answer. He says, well, we don't know what money is anymore. And he said it in sort of a forlorn way, you know. And this line even made it to the Jay Leno show. He said, and Jay Leno says, I don't know what kind of a person we need as chairman of the Federal Reserve, but it should be somebody that does know what money is, okay? We just can't have this Greenspan, okay? Which explains why the Federal Reserve switched from money supply targeting to interest rate targeting in the early 80s. They didn't know what money is anymore, okay? There are also other problems that I'm going to breeze through. Velocity of money, Friedman liked to treat it as constant, although he recognized it wasn't when the economy had a sharp downturn. But in normal times, it's constant. Well, it's not constant in these times. You can say, well, they're not normal. But we've had these times for about 5 or 6 years now. They're starting to be pretty normal. And velocity is all over the map, and how much people are hoarding money and how much they're getting rid of it, dishoarding it, and so on. I had charts for that, but you've seen too many charts. Bank operating ratios, it's driven by excess reserve. that magnitude has been off the charts and up and down. Geographical distribution of U.S. dollars, a whole bunch of them are in other countries, in Panama and Russia, Middle Eastern countries and elsewhere. And the Fed doesn't have an effective way of figuring out how much is in the U.S. Because if you write MV equal PQ, each of those variables has to stand for the same piece of geography. You can't have Q, GDP of the U.S., and M, all the money that the Fed has produced, if a whole bunch of it's in Russia and Middle Eastern countries and South American countries and so on, Argentina. So they don't know where the money is. They have board or they have meetings trying to figure out where the money is, and they don't have any real good way of doing it. Okay, yeah, I'll spend my last few minutes on this, and then I'll have to skip some stuff. But hey, that's okay. Better than running out of material. This is a short story. When the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics first cranked up, it was called Review of Austrian Economics at the time. Walter Block had a strategy to get some articles. And he would write people like Friedman. He did write Friedman. And he says, we want you to explain what you think is wrong with the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And Friedman wrote back and said, well, I've already explained that. I'm not going to spill any more ink on it. And Block says, well, I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Where was this? Well, it turns out it was in a draft research, interim research report in 1964. It's actually published in Optimum Quantity of Money and other essays. And he explained there. And one of the reasons he didn't want to write more, because he'd been out of monetary theory for years. He was working on school vouchers and that sort of thing. Well, then about the same time, the Western Economic Association invited him to a panel that was going to honor Friedman in his monetary work. And they asked him to write a paper for it. He writes about vouchers. He didn't write about... But they thought, well, I'll go back and get that old research and make it clear why I don't like the Austrian theory. And so that's what he wrote, and he published it. And he called it a plucking model. How many have heard of the plucking model? It doesn't get a lot of attention. So Friedman's plucking model. And he has a graph, and you can put almost anything on, put a big magnitude on the vertical axis. It'd be real output, real income, real employment, okay? Whatever you want. And then time on the horizontal axis. And then he says, if we draw he calls this an inclined plane. Okay, it's an upward sloping line. He said, if you look at the inclined plane, that might represent real growth if there are no problems in the economy. But what the economy does, it lapses from real growth occasionally, and he says that it's as if it plucked downwards. He said a string, but that really wouldn't work. Strings aren't too elastic. If it was elastic, it would bounce back. It's kind of like taffy or something like that. It's pulled down at various points and to various extents. And the down thing is the bust, he says, and the up thing is the boom. So he said, if you just look at this graph, you can see you don't have any boom-bust cycle, and you have a bust-boom cycle. And so it's not so much that the Austrians' theory isn't cute, it's just that it has no application, all right? Because you can see here that the bust is not related to the preceding boom. So much for the Austrians, and the only thing he added in the published version, he says in quotes or in parentheses, such as a theory of Mises. There, okay? And he didn't draw the plucking model, but I did, and this is it. There's Friedman. I left him off of it in the published version, but I wrote a comment. I wrote a comment on it that I also got published in the Western Economic Journal, which is where the plucking model was published. And it's been met with silence, I'm sorry to say, but at least it's in there, and I'm happy for that. And I explained about he's confusing a boom with a recovery. That's a recovery. And he's working at too high a level of aggregation between the plucks to detect the boom. In other words, the line between the plucks includes both consumption and investment. And so if one's going up and the other one's going down because of a distorted interest rate, that doesn't get picked up in this model, okay? And I thought I had won the day here, but the profession met it with silence. It's okay. Okay, I'm going to quit here because I'm out of time. Thank you.